I will be talking about the book that Johnny mentioned. It's here. I have a couple of copies, and what I'm going to do is circulate them around as I introduce the talk, because unfortunately my efforts to produce PowerPoints have failed because I left my memory stick in my office. So I'm very sorry about that. I will be able to circulate the slides around through Marita afterwards if you'd like to, but there's plenty here to talk through. So as I pass these around, I'll send one there, and at some point in the presentation I'll need to ask someone to get to the page number I want to show, but I'll let you know. The Growing Up in the New South Africa study was a collaborative effort based at the University of Cape Town in the Centre for Social Science Research. It was myself, Jeremy Seekings, who's a sociologist and political scientist, and then three of our master students who are working with us, Lauren Kahn and Sue Moses and Imke Huskens. And Jeremy and I dreamt up this project in about 2003, when we thought there's an awful lot of talk about child wellbeing in South Africa. And I'd done an analysis of what we know about child wellbeing in South Africa and where the gaps were. And what became clear in that was that we didn't really know much about ordinary childhoods, the everyday lived experience of children in the post-apartheid era. So we decided to embark on an interdisciplinary study to try and combine survey data with an in-depth ethnographic approach, which is one of those things that we all talk about as being sort of the ultimate aim of some research that really looks into in-depth and is actually can be quite difficult to achieve. So we set ourselves quite a challenge, and in this presentation what I want to do is to describe the research process, because I think the methodology and the ethic behind the research as both an intellectual journey and a human experience are quite important to what came out as a product. Towards the end of the presentation, I want to talk about what that product has meant, both in terms of a book and also what it catalyzed in terms of social change and processes within the valley that we studied, and more broadly, because I think it's interesting to see where these studies lead to. And in terms of the findings, as you can see, it's a big book. I won't be able to touch on everything. But what I'm going to do is draw out some of the particularly pertinent findings around neighborhood, education, and this question of childhood agency in the context of a very difficult circumstances and the new political dispensation. Okay, so why the study? We had several empirical questions to answer, to tackle. How are ordinary children's lives changing in the post-apartheid era? And we had a good look at the historical scholarly literature and also the popular literature, because as you might well be aware that in the apartheid era there were some restrictions as to the kind of research that people could do that was deemed as okay by the government. And therefore the coverage of research is fairly patchy. Sandra Berman and Pamela Reynolds put together a volume in the late 80s called Growing Up in a Divided Society, which drew on lots of different people's small-scale studies around particular vulnerabilities in childhood. And that was a very useful starting point for us, and as you will have realise, the titles of the two books resonate with each other. There's also been a lot of work by Andy Dawes and various other social psychologists looking at the effects of trauma and hardship and how young people and their families have worked through those. And then a body of anthropology, Pamela Reynolds' work, Patty Henderson's, Sean Jones's, looking at very specific communities of children and their families under apartheid. So we had a body of a baseline to work with, a little patchy, and we felt we needed to fill in the gaps a little bit through the popular literature. And of course, there's lots of fiction that's been written, and biography and autobiography, which was a really rich vein of material to tap into and very useful, and also gave us a sense of childhoods across the social class, race spectrum, more so than the academic literature did. We wanted to bring a comparative lens to the study and to look at that neighbourhoods in a fairly defined area that would be representative of the broader demography. Cape Town, as you probably know, has quite a specific demography in the South African context, in that the composition of the city is 85-90% Xhosa speaking and other language speaking Black African people, and a larger group of coloured people, and then a smaller minority of white people. And that's a particular demography of the city, and in the valley that we chose to study, which is the Fishhook Valley, it runs from the two ends of the Comakee Road, which is, if you know Cape Town, in the South Peninsula, south of the city. there are three neighbourhoods which under apartheid were segregated, white, coloured and black respectively, and still persist in terms of residential segregation to be fairly divided, but of course the legal divisions are no longer there, and in many ways many things have been freed up. I'll talk more about that later. So because these neighbourhoods are very close geographically, they provided a really interesting melting pot, if you like, of the issues that you could find in broader Cape Town. Our next question was, how do past and present lines of differentiation play out in children's lives and in their social identities? And we wanted to really sort of dig deeper into the nuances of the legacy of apartheid and see how, for children in their everyday lives, these things were playing out. The third one was, how do different spheres of children's lives intersect and influence each other? We found that in the body of qualitative work, we were finding a piece of work, say, on social stigma and HIV in a particular group of children. We found various bits of work on family life. We found various bits of work that were very education-focused, but nothing that really looked at, well, how does the educational environment and the family environment and the neighbourhood and the peer relationships, how do they actually relate to each other? And so that was a major thrust behind this study. We also wanted to look at in terms of everyday experience and also children's perceptions. And then finally, where do children have power? How do they use it and where do they encounter its limits in changing their own realities and those of people who are significant in their lives? We also had some questions of concept and of method, thinking about how closely the constructs used to frame children's lives reflect their lived experiences and meaning. So to really interrogate the notion of childhood from children's points of view, family, community, education, race, sex, you know, terms that are common in the everyday media and in our scholarship as well. And how do these inform our understanding of child well-being and poverty? The questions required a very different methodology, as I alluded to. There's been a critique levelled at many bodies of childhood research that it tends to be cross-sectional and limited to small qualitative studies. And we wanted to try and do something a bit different, to try and get as much of a longitudinal perspective as would be possible. And I'll speak more about that in a moment. And then finally, to think about questions of representation. So to select an area, as I just described, that was as representative of a broader picture, but also to be able to really dig in deep and look. So we wanted to achieve that contextual sensitivity from the ethnography. We had five disciplines represented on our team, so politics and sociology, social development, psychology, and social anthropology. But to really actually become interdisciplinary, it requires more than just having different disciplines on your team. You've got to actually think interdisciplinary. You've got to think how your data is going to be collected, how you're going to start off a process in which those two bodies of data can talk to each other and you can learn. And we were eager to see what a happy marriage between those two approaches might look like. And it was quite a journey. So the research process entailed the Cape Area Panel Study, which is an initiative of Jeremy Seekings and David Lamb from Michigan, which comprises a survey that's completed by 4,500 young people aged 14 to 22 across Greater Cape Town. So we had the entire metropole included there. There were three waves conducted between 2001 and 2007. And the questionnaire asked about everything that you would imagine between health and domestic arrangements, mobility, education, aspirations, employment, dating, sexual relationships. There was all sorts of topics covered. And then, so there were two waves conducted during the period that we did our research. So we had that time span to be able to look at what young people were saying they were going to do and then actually what happened a bit later in terms of the survey responses. The ethnography was conducted for 16 months in the valley that I described. There were three of us adult researchers doing that, and we worked with 85 young participants aged 9 to 22, plus their families, their teachers and their social workers and various other significant adults that we met and discovered along the road, as these iterative processes lead you into. We also recruited six adolescent volunteer researchers who are keen to join our team because they wanted to learn some of the skills of social science. We recruited them through the high schools that we worked in, and they joined us and were extremely helpful in terms of refining our questions, enabling us to think about topics that hadn't occurred to us as being important, and at opening up some of the ways into quite sensitive discussions in a way that was acceptable and appropriate for young people. In terms of methodology, we used participant observation to the point at which it was appropriate within a South African context. I worked primarily in Masipumelele, which is largely an informal settlement, although there are more and more brick houses being built. I didn't actually live in Masipumelele. I lived about 4 kilometres away and was there daily. So we weren't embedded in the sort of true anthropological way of waking up and spending our entire days there. We spent the bulk of most days in and out of schools, social works environments, as we got to know children being invited back to their homes. And it was one of those organic iterative processes where we met children in various different contexts. We combined informal observation, conversation, artwork, diaries, drama, various different interactive methods that helped us elicit the data. And as you look at the books, have a look at the early section and you'll see some of the artwork and mapping that we used to elicit some of the data. We started off in schools because we felt that we needed to understand, we needed to be in classrooms and in a school environment to really understand what it's like to sit in a classroom for a period of months. So, and that started off as an inquiry, obviously through Department of Education and getting all the ethical permission and working with the teachers and understanding how one could be in a classroom. It's a bit difficult just to be, you can't just be a fly on the wall, one needs to be there and have a role. So we found ourselves doing all sorts of different things, from classroom assistant to occasionally taking lessons, which gave us the perspective of the teachers as well as the students, and facilitating in periods where there weren't people around to be able to do that. We also did a lot of discourse analysis with the local media. There are 2 papers that are produced for the South Peninsula in particular, it's called the Northern Echo and the People's Post. So we looked at the way in which children's lives and childhood and youth were written about, the images that were chosen by journalists, and the responses of the public through letters around issues that were facing youth. So everything from drugs to sex to crime, to you can imagine there were all sorts of things. And we also looked at the language of service providers in terms of how they were thinking about young people in the valley. I have a picture here, and if those of you have got the books, have a quick look at the beginning. We used a lot of artwork using very simple technologies. It was large bits of brown paper, crayons or candles even, and food colouring, and asked young people who were at the schools and who wanted to come to an after-school activity that the three of us, that the ethnographers in the valley were running. And we set up art clubs, basically, which were voluntary. About 20 children came to each of those, one in Masipumelele, one in Fishhook, which was the previously white-only neighbourhood, and one in Ocean View. And we used those opportunities to get to know a much smaller group of people, of children, very well. And it was through collaborative art plus individual art that we started to build the kind of levels of trust that you need to do some of this research. We found that was a very useful way into enabling young people to map their domestic lives. So for instance, the picture in the early part of the book, and it's the one I'm showing here, it's very easy to see, but we asked young people to map their yard. And in a township context, you'll understand that the yard is much more than the physical space outside the hut in which you, or the shack in which you live. It's about the set of social relationships that you come back to at the end of every day. It's about with whom you organise the care of your family. And it led us into conversations about shared resources, be they the water or the sanitary facilities or childcare, food, etc. And a sort of glimpse into young people's lives. We also asked young people to collectively map many facets of their neighbourhoods. And again, at the beginning of the book, there's some of those pictures. And we used sheets of paper that were about as big as one of these tables here, just before the line of the cloth, so that the group could actually get around and say, OK, here's Komaki Road, here's where we live, this is where the school is. And we used that as a sort of physical representation of the neighbourhood, but also to talk about where young people felt comfortable to walk. And so they shaded in one colour the areas that they go to regularly and feel very comfortable, and shaded another colour where they don't feel comfortable. And that led us into conversations about power relationships and othering and all sorts of other very relevant topics. We also wanted to map where young people go for certain things they need that are beyond the household, and also their perceptions of danger, their perceptions of where fun and leisure are to be found. And it was very interesting, and we also found that those maps enabled us to plot employment relationships. So some of the young people in Maspumalele knew Fishhook through the fact that their auntie or their mother worked in somebody's house in Fishhook, but they only knew that area of Fishhook rather than other areas of Fishhook. And then we also used this as a way into thinking about mobility, and we found that through the mapping that young people in Maspumalele were very independently mobile, much more so than their counterparts in Fishhook, the middle class, previously white only area. And I don't know those of you who've got the book, but there's quite a stylized and quite a beautiful image done by a 13-year-old girl from Fishhook who mapped her community. And the very striking thing about it is that the buildings on it include her house, her friend's house, her father's workplace, which is quite some distance, at least half an hour's drive away from Fishhook. But they don't have any roads joining them. Whereas the maps by those children who walk between the different locations that form their daily lives are very accurate in terms of routes. And that's because young people in Fishhook are driven everywhere, and they don't actually know what it happens in between their own house and maybe even their best friend's house. And they wouldn't know the route, they wouldn't go there on their own. And these gave us some clues into aspects of young people's agency that we would follow up later. Following those sorts of collective art pieces and mapping exercises, we then used a process called, I don't know if you any of you have come across the group of narrative therapy techniques that an organisation called REPSI have developed, the Regional Psychosocial Initiative, I think it's called. Jonathan Morgan did a lot of work using body maps and memory boxes at the University of Cape Town, specifically working with families and individuals who are HIV affected as a way of recording lives before sickness and ultimately before death. And we adapted one of these called the Hero Book, and that enabled each child to be able to author and illustrate a book about their own lives. So they were the hero, the author, and the illustrator. And that was an exercise that probably took us, I would say, about 6 months. And every week we would do a different component and a page for the book. And sometimes it was about family life, sometimes it was about their life's journey, their ancestry, their origins, about cultural references that were very important in their rural home of origin and still important in their urban life. Sometimes it was about emotions, anger, moments when things were out of control and difficult. So it was a very useful way of gradually building a picture of young people's lives. Okay, so on to some of the results. Any questions of clarification on the methods at this point? You're welcome to wave at me if something's not comprehensible. I want to talk a little bit about schools as sites of integration, because there's been a lot of literature written about the potential and the actuality of schools as able to lead in some respect the process of transformation in South Africa. Now, in the Fishhook Valley, as in much of South Africa, integration has only been in one direction, and you will know what I'm meaning here, in that the much more integrated school in Fishhook is probably about 20% by now, 25% non-white. In Ocean View, there are young coloured people, residents of Ocean View who go there, who comprise 80% of the population, and 20% of those are black students from Masipumalele who walk to Ocean View and study there. In Masipumalele, it's 100% of Masipumalele's school population is from the local community, are black Africans speaking different languages, but there's no integration the other direction for all sorts of reasons. So the integration is a picture that we need to look at. When we talk to teachers in Fishhook, their perspective is that integration is about using English and adapting to the system. So it's much more about moving into a system that already exists rather than the system changing terribly much. They were positive about diversity, but interestingly silent about categories and prejudice that still exist in the school. They spoke about the inclusion of all, their ethic, what they were trying to achieve in the classroom was very much about inclusivity, yet there was a persistent rhetoric of us and them. So they've got the sort of two layers and levels of integration going on. In terms of children's strategies, they were quite vocal about being totally fed up with the apartheid story, and that apartheid is not our reality, is what they say. It's not the way in which we work. They would use humour and play to sort of combat some of the categories, some of the racialised categories. You've probably heard some of these CIT, which stands for coloured in training. You know, so people would jibe at each other and say, oh, you're a CIT, you're a half a Nazi, you're a top deck. It's that chocolate, which is brown on the bottom and white on the top. So ways of sort of playing with some of the racialised terminology and using humour to get around it. Coconut, all these sort of little slang words. Or they would talk about acting a colour and as a way of humorising, taking the edge out of it and dealing with the fact that at the end of the day, what we realise through all these conversations is that young people are really keen to find another way about talking about difference, but actually don't have the lexicon, the vocabulary, to think and talk about difference in another way than race. And that seems to be a common stumbling block across all neighbourhoods, class, race, whatever you want to call sort of sex of the population. And it's partly because at the supper table at home or in common, in everyday chat with peers or wherever young people hang out, the adults aren't using other ways of talking about difference than race. And so it's difficult for children to pick up different ways of thinking. And also because their mobility, as I described earlier, is either highly restricted, full stop, for example, young people in Fishhook, or it's along particular lines and to specific other communities in which there are already social networks rather than more broadly. So their agency in this regard is quite limited. And there's, we found through the six young researchers that I alluded to earlier, what we would do every week is meet in one of their homes. So Tando lived in a shack in Maspumalele. Ricardo lived in a sort of shack around the back of a house that was half built in Ocean View. Samantha lived in a flat in Fishhook. And we would have our meetings in one of those places. Sometimes they would come to my house. And we would use that opportunity to be in a different space together and talk about how it felt to be in a space that was not comfortable or familiar. And that opened up all sorts of conversations around the difference between knowing about a space and being in a space, the anthropological habitus notion, and that was very, very interesting. In terms of educational pathways, there was a very interesting set of data that emerged in using the quantitative data set, the panel study, and the ethnography together to really look at the differences between educational realities and what we thought at the time were educational expectations. And I'm going to unpack this a little bit. As you'll know, there are extremely stark inequalities in school achievement in South Africa. Cape Town's no exception. Very, very large numbers of children and youth fail school. And while there's a national discourse around schools failing children, it reverses this and says, okay, what's going on with the system? And what's going on in South African education system is another whole seminar. That discourse isn't expressed very readily at a local level. So there isn't much at the time in this valley, there wasn't much challenge to the fact that schools are delivering a service and that service is thought to be good enough. On the whole, many parents felt that the school would be delivering the service that they had understood that either they had access to when they were children or that they didn't have access to but wanted their children to be able to have access to now. One exception, which I write about in the book, was that there was a major student demonstration in Maspumalele when the pupils got thoroughly fed up with inconsistencies in the teachers' promises. It was all around the fact that many pupils had brought money to go into school to pay for transport to go and watch their peers compete in an athletics tournament. And then for some reason the deputy head collected the money and then turned around and said, no, we're not going to go. And this incited an absolute outrage. And it was the straw that broke the camel's back on a sort of cumulative experiences of pupil trust being broken. And it escalated. Students refused to come out of the classroom, teachers refused to go in, the headmaster called the police came, and it was a sort of 80s scene with rubber bullets flying and all the rest of it. And that was the only instance of challenge to school authority that we witnessed. And it went, there was no discussion, there was no opportunity for discussion and discourse because it flew into that very aggressive scenario. Young people state extraordinarily high expectations of, for their own lives. You chat to the average 13-year-old across the demography, ask them what they'd like, to, what they intend for the future, and they'll talk about wanting to become a pilot or owning a business or a lawyer or a doctor, and very high aspirations. And by and large, certainly in Fishhook, Masipumalele, and a large proportion of the Ocean View students stay in school and really want to be there. And the, so, and in Masipumalele, you often, some of the classrooms are 22-year-olds, 23-year-olds, really sticking at it, trying to get them a trick. So the question is, what do they expect to achieve? And we really needed to use our survey and our findings and our ethnography to tackle this. And those of you who have the books, if you don't mind turning to page 219, because that's, there's a set of graphs on there that I wanted to show you, and I'll do my best with what I've got here. If you look at the educational realities of adolescents, age 20 to 22 by neighbourhood, you'll find a pattern that the realities for young white people are very, very different to the realities for other sectors of the population. What we did is looked at both class and race, because race is not a good enough proxy for class anymore in South Africa. It used to be, but not anymore. And we found that, by and large, a large proportion of white young people were achieving matric, going on to college, and in a other sort of post-matric or technical college university environment. That's not the case for other groups, and particularly poor African areas and very poor African areas were 60-70% were not even achieving matric. In wealthier coloured areas, that's more like 50%, middle-income coloured areas more like 60%. So even in communities where incomes have increased, the educational shortfall is still great. Now, if you compare those graphs to the results of when we asked through the survey what 14 to 17-year-olds expected to achieve, they are a very, very different picture, apart from amongst white people. The young white students' reported expectations roughly align with the realities. In the other communities, the expectations were very, very inflated when you look at what actually came about. As young people age, so the difference between what 22-year-olds were saying and compared to 14 to 17-year-olds, their aspirations, their expectations are a little more reflective of reality, but still very, very different. So one has to ask, what's happening here? Are we actually getting expectations when we're asking questions in a survey, or are we getting something different? And what transpired is that, I'll say what transpired and I'll tell you how we got to it. What we were actually collecting there were aspirations rather than expectations. We looked closely at the wording of the question, and we also picked up a discourse in the communities, all three communities, that education is a linear, there's a linear pathway between trying hard at school, at getting your matric, achieving educationally, getting into a training of some sort, and achieving a job, not just a menial job, but a high status job. And young people really consistently spoke of two pathways in life. One is the good pathway, in which the one I just outlined, in which you try hard and you dedicate yourself and you're on a path, and as long as you try hard, that pathway will take you there. That's the assumption. The bad pathway is the pathway of fun, that ultimately leads to joblessness, crime, and inferior social status. And the interesting thing in this discourse is that these pathways are considered parallel at the moment, if we're all teenagers, but ultimately divergent. So it's as if one is on the good pathway, and that's where one wants to stay, but one's very aware that the other pathway exists, and it's a reality that many of one's peers are treading, that you don't want to be there, but it's there, and you know in the back of your mind that you might be there. So we were trying to understand how that relates to young people's agency within a very difficult educational environment. It's one of the things that saddened and angered us most during this research was working with young people who were highly committed, highly articulate, highly intelligent, and yet weren't able to progress through school. The structural inequalities rarely featured in young people's explanations as to why achieving their aspirations was difficult. education is seen as a route to equality by individuals and largely by society. And as I said before, parent figures largely accept a system that is assumed to work as it used to, and as it used to for other communities. Society's collective investment in schooling seems to mask the critical differentials in young people's knowledge and networks. So the fact that everybody believed in this educational pathway masked the fact that young people didn't know that they didn't know what's needed to tread a pathway. So there was not an awareness of the gaps in knowledge. The sorts of things that take you between a matric and a college, it's not just the fact that you pass, the sorts of savviness that you need to understand whether you're on track for your matric in the first place. If you're passing all your accountancy exams in your classroom, I can understand why young people feel that they must be on track. But actually, if you pass your internal exams, does not mean to say that you're going to pass your external exams. All sorts of issues around language came up. In Maspumalele High School at the time, grade 10 students were taking their accountancy exams in isiXhosa. The papers were in English. They knew the conceptual stuff. They couldn't translate the technical language of isiXhosa into the technical language of English in order to write the exam and succeed. So all these things were mitigated against them. And then there was the thought that started to emerge, was that in the context of vast unemployment and really massive challenges in moving into the work sphere, perhaps retaining this idea of this pathway, this linear model, is the best protection in this context, that actually it's at a psychological level it works. But does it work for very long? No. And this led us into questions around power within and notions of agency. Now, of course, there's little predictability for young people in most neighbourhoods in South Africa. It's very difficult to live one's life in a way that is according to one's plans. So we wanted to try to find out to what extent young people feel in control in these kind of contexts. And what we found is that, again, using the survey data, the degree of self-efficacy that young people are asked to rate how much in control they felt of their lives from sort of scale of 1 to 4, and that their stated self-efficacy varied inversely with historical privilege. In other words, those who were privileged in the past reported themselves to be less self-efficacious than those who continue to be poor and in the past whose families were very much disadvantaged. So that was an interesting finding. And the variation within poor sectors of the population suggested that two things were at play, both a collective identity and a kind of community identity, a cultural identity. For example, in the coloured neighbourhood in Ocean View, there are notions of this is in the past it was difficult for us because we were the wrong colour, we were not pale enough. In the current dispensation, we're not dark enough. You know, these kind of discourses float around, and they do contribute to a community identity and a sense in which young people feel we have a political place, we're part of society, we are equal citizens, or we're equally the benefits of efforts to redress the past, for example, affirmative action, BEE, are equally accessible to us as to the black population. But those sorts of discourses are counteracted by other discourses. So we found that these sorts of things did seem to mould the way in which people were reporting their self-efficacy. But because we had variation within those groups, it couldn't explain everything. And then there therefore must be individual sense of agency at play as well. We then needed to use the ethnography to try and understand where and how children leverage a degree of control in their lives. And we found that just by that gradual process I outlined earlier of getting to know young people's social networks, who they use, when, and for what, to access the kind of nurture that, for various reasons, home was not able to provide. To what extent were they able to find food, clothing, care, a listening ear, a piece of advice, a social connection that would lead them into a training opportunity, all those things from the local neighbourhood. And extensively they were doing that. And we were quite struck by the very strategic way in which young people knew that a particular neighbour down the road, 3 blocks away, had a particular resource and was used for that. They were at home between certain hours and would be happy to open the door and have that young person in for a few hours while their parent was coming back from work or something, or that they were particularly well connected in a certain employment sphere. So different people for different purposes. And they also made a very, very good use of discursive resources outside the home as well, and of physical resources in terms of protecting themselves, because violence is very much a reality in these communities, and young people knew that in order to retain their social connections and keep that mobility, they needed to cross areas of the neighbourhood that were not very safe, and they knew who to walk with through those neighbourhoods. So from that perspective, a considerable degree of agency, and quite effective agency in the short term. But the upshot of some of these emphatically bifurcated options that I was describing earlier, the two paths in life, was that young people achieved a temporary power in the security of being on the right path, quote unquote. But the starkness of the choice, the fact that it was this or that, there was no in between, you were either on the right path or off it, the great difficulties in actually sustaining the good path, for reasons of the educational environment, for reasons of family economy, for reasons of peer environment in which your young people would speak about being pulled into the easier, fun option, all sorts of pressures. I haven't even mentioned gender and power in terms of sexual relationships. There's a whole chapter on that. And the fact that young people, in describing how one stays on the pathway, would emphasize personal effort and efficacy and even morality as how one stays on the pathway. The fact that all these were delineating the kind of agency that they were describing ultimately meant that they were disempowering. I don't know if you can follow the logic in that argument, but the fact that they led ultimately to a position of self-blame and a position in which they could regard themselves as lacking the moral integrity to pursue the pathway led young people into an ultimately disempowering position. And it was very difficult for them to sustain nurturing relationships or progress towards goals. So the question is, well, why are young people optimistic for so long? Why in that survey questionnaire did they report their aspirations to these high status careers and a great degree of personal efficacy? Well, one possibility is that, and that was reflected in the difference between the two age groups, that they were not yet old enough and didn't have enough experience yet to counteract the discourse that everybody was living by, to actually have the personal experience of saying, well, no, it's not like that, actually. We don't just move smoothly from school to passing a matric into college. And many young people didn't know enough people who they felt had really tried and tested that route to know that why it wasn't possible. And the other possibility is that it was just too awful to contemplate the alternative, that the alternative was something they really wanted to avoid, and it was difficult to contemplate it. Okay, I want to just move on to our now and sort of sum up, well, how have childhoods changed? That was our, as you might remember, our first empirical question. It is definitely the case that young people have greater opportunities than they did under apartheid, but the access to these is restricted to most young people by extreme inequalities. Some of them are ongoing familiar inequalities from apartheid days, and some of them have a new guise, and I think some of the things I've just been talking about help to expose those. And within neighbourhoods, there's a variety of negative social forces that young people were incredibly articulate about. They spoke about violence, they spoke about addiction, they spoke about gossip, and they also spoke about denigration, particularly in Ocean View, the coloured community, about the ways in which their families, their friends, the people they expected and hoped would be their supports and their allies, would undermine their efforts to succeed. And denigration was a hugely problematic issue to deal with, because it was a form of socialising and repartee and discourse that was very pervasive. And the way they responded was interesting. It was first to reject this and say, well, no, they might malign me, but I'm not going to fall into that trap of thinking about myself in that way. They would resist it. They would talk about the way in which the media was partly responsible for these attitudes, the othering, the stereotyping. But then interestingly, at some point, many of them capitulated and would say things like, well, if they all believe that I'm going to be pregnant by the time I'm 14, I may as well be. And in some of those young people's lives, that transpired. So it was an interesting sort of relationship with that discourse that it was very difficult. In terms of their position in society, children would recognise that there were restrictions on their self-determination because of the way childhood was constructed. And it was constructed, and I hope we do a good enough job in the book explaining this, but there are ideologies and inequalities and notions of childhood that prevail across those three communities that are something about the history of the whole country and ideologies around what's a child and when does a child become an adult that were quite pervasive across all three communities. And then within each of those three communities, variations on that construction. And it was almost as if the forms of agency that I described and young people's abilities to access resources, some of those were recognised by adults and spoken about and were in the public domain, if you like. Others were not recognised, and particularly children's emotional competence and ability to understand and deal with illness, poverty, death were features of their lives that adults were slow to recognise and slow to trust children with knowledge. So a lot of knowledge management by adults was happening, and a lot of knowledge management by children was happening, and it was children felt that adults didn't recognise their capacities in that regard. It was also difficult, another limit was the neighbourhood's limit in terms of what's possible and acceptable, and I just described some of those. And then in terms of youth efforts to achieve their personal goals and their health, we felt that they were thwarted by what we referred to in the book as a quiet violence, a neighbourhood-specific yet repeated set of issues that are about the social environment in neighbourhoods that impeded young people's agency in this regard, and left them feeling that they'd failed both themselves and their families, which could lead to an undermining of their own capacities. Okay, I'm aware I'm running towards my time limit. In terms of the questions of concept and method that we set out to explore, we felt that the qualitative and quantitative analysis gave us a really strong base for triangulation, and it was fascinating and fantastic to be able to use the two data sets in that way. We felt that we succeeded in having two data sets that were mutually informative within certain constraints. You know, of course, when you're in the process of analysis, you say, oh, I wish we could have designed the survey in a different way to do this, because the ethnography is showing us that actually this question would have been better asked in this way. And the structure of research is such that you can't go backwards. It was certainly an iterative process, and as integrated as we had hoped, no doubt there's scope for more. And what it allowed us to do was to open up some of the common constructs of childhood, to look at childhood as not just as a period of life and a sort of life stage, but to look at the reciprocity within discourses of respect. Those of you who know Southern African well will be familiar with discourses of respect that exist within families and are constructed along lines of seniority and age grades and things. And it seemed at first that this was a rather impenetrable relationship from the point of view of children, that it was always going to be that a respect discourse meant that you needed to obey and the authority of those senior to you. With further analysis and the ethnography revealed that actually young people had quite a lot of say in their homes, and that they expected and also received a lot of respect from their seniors, and it was a much more of a two-way relationship than the discourse suggests. We looked at the issues of well-being as a relational quality, and that what was very interesting is that across those three neighbourhoods, young people who participated in research were in absolute agreement around what it is in terms of relationships in the home, the school, peer relationships that make them of quality, that are the key criteria, and issues of trust, communication, openness, mutual respect came up regardless of cultural background. I'd like to, if I can, just talk a little bit about how the book's been used. Is that okay? Got a moment. when we were pulling all this data together, a lot of people asked us the question, so you're going to write a scholarly book, what about a popular book? And we sort of thought about this for a while and thought, well, it is interesting material, lots of people locally were interested in it, and what we decided to try to do is to write a book that was a scholarly book but that was accessible to the lay audience as well. And we seem to have achieved that in the sense that the book is being read very widely. What we don't do is specifically address policy. We haven't come up with a set of recommendations. We haven't said, right, these are our findings, what are all the government and other actors' policies around children and how do they relate? What we've done is say, okay, this is a detailed picture of the interlocking social spaces in children's lives, and we've left it at that so that policymakers and practitioners can take from it what they will. We found that it is widely used across the scholarly communities, both in Southern Africa, Europe, and also in the US. Lots of groups of American students seem to have been set the work and come across to South Africa on their J terms and want to have, I've been asked to be a sort of scholarly tour trip planner. They want to go and visit all these places, which I have to monitor. It's a great pleasure to be able to take students around and introduce them to some of the areas. And then interestingly, in the business community, and this surprised us, Engine Oil have led the way in asking us to help them and their senior management team and also some of their business colleagues as a circle of businesses that work together under the Ubuntu umbrella. And they've been thinking about other routes into the question of transformation than the old race thing, and said, well, we'd actually like to understand about how young people's lives are working, and won't you come and help the senior management think about issues of generation and youth? And so that was a very interesting thing. And various political lobbying groups have also used the book as well as civil society groups embarking on research. There's something called the New Women's Movement, who are a great cohort of women from all manner of different communities, ranging from, as far as I could work out, 16 through to 85, who are passionate about women's socioeconomic rights, civil rights, and family life, and wanted and used the book as a way of describing some of the issues that they perceive in their communities and training up and inskilling some of their members in social research. Then in terms of the catalyst that it became for social change, there are various local initiatives and changes in the way schools were starting to think about the question of integration that came about as a result of the research. And I can talk more about those if you'd like to. Me too. So I think I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Rachel. Thank you.